Welcome to Session 3 of the PDH Online course on the 2008 National Electric Code. We're going to go into Article 110, Requirements for Electrical Installation. And as I indicated, this is, now I won't, it's unfair to say this, but perhaps 80% of the problems in electrical design, 80% of the approval problems, 80% of the inspection problems are related to these requirements for electrical installation. And speculating on why that might be, the code is very clear, the workspace required around equipment. Any place there's a removable panel, you've got to have between 3 and 4 feet to get into it and work on it safely. You can't be pressed up against it working with your fingers right in front of your face. That's not legal. There must be space for a craftsman to pay attention to what he's doing, work slowly and carefully, and you know, have light on it. Well, and that's what we're looking for. I mean, after we go through all these rules, that's the end of the day, that it must be possible for the serviceman to get in there and do it. And people don't do that. Well, why don't they do that? I think it's because equipment changes even after the project starts. It turns out that there's a 6-week delivery on a component that's needed next week, and you can air freight it in, and after it gets here, you find out it's the wrong size. Now, that's a made-up story, certainly, but things like that do happen. It turns out that there's a cheaper version that's bigger. Well, why would the cheaper one be bigger? And I can't explain this. These things come out of the factory. Actually, I'm working on a current job where they specified all the pumps. Hey, that's what mechanical engineers do. All the submittals were for larger pumps. Why was that? Well, this is a mechanical engineering thing. I'm not really qualified to comment, but something about being non-overloading. Instead of getting the stated pump with a non-overloading curve, they got a bigger pump that meets the requirements with lower efficiency, more energy usage, and a bigger footprint. But things happen, and things happen in every project, and the result is too often that there's not enough workspace around the equipment. And every inspector has a tape, you know, I mean, it shows up, it doesn't slip past. These are the rules the inspector will enforce. Occasionally, a plans examiner will pick up inadequate clearances, but it's much more obvious as the equipment is being installed. It's also more expensive to rip it out and figure a new place to mount it. Section 110.2 discusses approval. This is the section which is tightening in each revision of the code. It used to be that you could, the installer could ask the inspector for a variance. The inspector would say, go ahead, do it, and the problem was solved. Well, they're trying so hard to get all of this documented. The intention is that the designer and the contractor are supposed to follow the code. Exceptions are supposed to have rare, well-thought-out documentation in writing. As indicated in the introduction to this chapter of the code, however, this part is enforced in the field where procedures are different. The code is a very solid starting point, but the local inspector probably enforces some peculiar interpretations based upon a bad experience in his past. Local contractors are aware of this. Out-of-town contractors learn painfully. The local inspector and contractor are used to oral exceptions, which are immediately covered up by the drop ceiling equipment cover or plaster. Section 110.3 discusses examination, identification, installation, and use of equipment. Examination means different things in different jurisdictions. In my experience, examination means that the equipment is UL listed. This means that fabricated equipment has a UL licensed inspector who looks at it and puts a sticker with a unique listing number on it. Members of my live class in New York State used the National Electric Code report, the use of the National Electric Code by the building standard reviewers and inspectors is much more aggressive. This is the section which incorporates manufacturer's installation instructions into the code. There's a very real gotcha here. The designer does not get to see the instructions, except in cases of full disclosure at the manufacturer's website. That means that there are clearly indicated limitations and requirements which are unknown to the designer and discovered only by diligent contractor foreman. Individual lighting dimmers and switch boxes have been a prominent and painful example of this. Many have cooling fins larger than the box space. They work fine in single-gang application, but some fins have to be trimmed off for multi-gang use. This reduces the load capacity. It's clearly explained in the instructions, but the first time you see it, it's a surprise nonetheless. Interrupting rating 110.9. This section is so quiet and mild that it's hard to believe the problems it's created. Equipment must have rating to survive available current which flows into a downstream fault. The problem is that you have to know the available fault current. This requires a calculation for each piece of equipment of the impedances between it and the source, and the addition of any motor contribution, which will backflow during a fault. The effort is possible for installing a single piece, but only computer programs can handle a large electrical design. Also, this is a mandate to equipment manufacturers to determine the withstand and interrupting ratings, as control panels like machine controls and HVAC controls have been included in the code. This becomes a challenge. Panel manufacturers have started to attempt to comply with this section. They've discovered that a current limiting fuse at the main disconnect is not enough. If there is enough fault current available, as in large industry, then a motor fault can pull enough short circuit current to destroy the motor starter and overloads before the main trips. This is specifically addressed later in the code, and the conclusion is not to let it happen. Mechanical execution of work, section 110.12. Another stealth section to the neophyte designer or installer. Everything must be installed in a workmanlike manner. This appears unenforceable in its vagueness, but has been interpreted to mandate following ANSI NECA 1-2006 standard practices for workmanship in electrical construction. The standard itself is well written and has meaningful content and is stringent enough to be enforced by electrical inspectors and engineers who want to have pride in the appearance of work. My experience is that good contractors and foremen have the same goal, and when shortcuts are taken in appearance, there are also shortcuts in wiring details. Mounting and cooling of equipment, 110.13. This section specifically states that equipment must be mounted so the required cooling is possible. This comes back to the manufacturer's instructions, which you don't get to see until it's uncrated. The wary designer knows which equipment generates a lot of waste heat, which must be rejected into the environment. This means side and back clearances. Because of common requirement for competitive bidding, it's essential to include generous cooling clearances in the plant layout. If a less costly but larger unit is provided, it will still fit. Electrical connections, 110.14. There's a field problem that's recognized and addressed by this section, wires into lugs. Previously, electricians often made T connections by placing incoming and outgoing conductors under a single lug. This is now permitted, but only when the lug is rated for the count and size of conductors. Another place this shows up is on panel breaker lugs, one circuit per lug unless labeled otherwise. The last place this shows up is when you choose oversized conductors to avoid a voltage drop or to provide future capacity. Big wires into small lugs don't go. There are reducing pin crimps that handle this. They're specifically intended for using the larger copper to go into a copper-rated termination, but they're an off-the-shelf item at distributors. And a box extension and pigtail will also work. The code section says that trimming strands to use an unlisted size is not legal. 110.14, electrical connections. This section specifically allows the use of direct burial splice kits. I normally recommend heavy-duty installation, building wire in Schedule 80 PVC or Schedule 40 PVC in a concrete duct bank. But there are situations like a driveway that's constantly being dug up or a long run to a pump house that justify direct burial power cable at the legal depth. A later paragraph in this section mandates use of wire at its 60-degree rating for equipment connections. As previously discussed, the feeder circuit can be 90C at its 90C rating, with a short, larger pigtail of wire used at its 60-degree 60-degree rating. It's not legal to connect the pigtail in the gutter space, as this may exceed the cubic inch rating of the gutter. To play the game, you need a gutter extension or an external terminal box. To avoid the problem, use 90-degree wire at a 60-degree rating. Section 110.16, flash protection, which really means labels. This is the famous section requiring field-applied arc flash labels. To be code compliant, the designer must remind the installer to apply arc flash warning labels, with no particular wording beyond warning arc flash hazard. Now I say again, the National Electric Code doesn't require anything more than a simple arc flash warning label with no particular wording, something like warning arc flash hazard. This is the point where interpretation has far exceeded the wording of the code. As you might guess, the label is not protection. Personal protective equipment, flame retardant shirt, flame retardant pants over cotton underwear, goggles, gloves, and a strictly followed safe procedure policy are protection. The procedure always starts with work only on de-energized equipment except in extraordinary situations. Safety-conscious firms are now requiring tag-out, lock-out, and safety grounds on supply feeders before working on equipment. Further, the feeders shall be considered energized and full PPE utilized until they've been tested and proved to be de-energized. Some people even go a step further and ground out the supply conductors so that if something bad happens at the lock-out, the workman is still protected. There is a group promoting the interpretation that operating a power switch on normal equipment with the door closed is an arc flash hazard, and personal protective equipment is required, along with standing beside the equipment, not in front, and looking away. The thought arises from documented cases of catastrophic failures taking place under these circumstances. And there's something on the web that illustrates this in tremendous detail with pictures of the equipment that destroyed itself. It's Brookhaven National Laboratories, and I think you'll need the paper version to get the website, but it's www.efcog.org/wg/esh_elec_safety_20/arc-flash%20, incident%20, 6_19_07%20(parentheses DURNAM, DURNAM)/PDF. We're talking about the arc flash labeling section. An earlier section required that equipment be applied within its short circuit withstand rating. Both are leading to a requirement for a short circuit study for each electric power design. The step has been taken by some design firms as NEC compliance, whether required by the authority having jurisdiction or not. The National Electric Code still requires only general arc flash warning labels, but NFPA 70E, Safe Electrical Work Practices, requires detailed labels indicating energy available in joules per square centimeter and required level of PPE. And I'm told that OSHA is enforcing NFPA 70E under the General Duty Clause. Marking under 110.21, equipment, which now includes control panels, transient voltage surge suppressors, and such, must carry a label showing the manufacturer, voltage, current, and short circuit withstand. NEMA equipment has been doing this for years, but it's a new idea for panel builders, even when severely arm-twisted by large industrial buyers. I say this from inspecting equipment. Identification of disconnecting means, old, long-standing requirement, almost universally disregarded. Other sections require that disconnecting means be present, but this section requires they be labeled. Unenforceable commentary suggests the use of ordinary words, which actually describe the equipment being disconnected, not just an acronym like XB-212. A later paragraph in this section requires labeling of series combination rated systems. The labels are pretty easy. Understanding series combination rated systems is not so easy. Normally, when you have a panel fed by conductors which can deliver 25,000 amp fault current, you would buy a panel rated at 42,000 amps. Give yourself some headroom. It's legal, per the series combination rated system, to use a 42,000 amp main and 10,000 amp branch breakers, if and only if the main will open before the branch breakers, so the branch breakers never see the 42,000 arc of operation. This is legal and cheaper. The section of the code says the box must be labeled to make sure that only identical breakers are used for maintenance replacement in the future. The underlying question is whether the designer is willing to trust a label to ensure safe maintenance in the future. If not, do not use series combination rated systems. If so, make sure the labels are applied. Spaces around electrical equipment. 110.26, and this is worth studying closely because there's a table that I'm paraphrasing here, and it may not apply in your case, so it's better to read the exact table and the fine print and make sure you're totally conversant in this. But my summary goes as follows. The basic rules are to provide a minimum of 42 inch in front of 600 volt equipment, more for medium voltage, a minimum of 30 inch wide workspace in front of the equipment, like a single full voltage non-reversing starter or narrow panel board, and clear space above and below. Now let me say that again, because there's so much there in just a brief statement, and it sounds so obvious and easy until you get into a non-compliant situation. Minimum of 42 inches in front of 600 volt equipment. That means so you can step back, you are not pressed up against the equipment while you're testing it. And there are cases where it's 48 inches. Minimum of 30 inch wide workspace in front of the equipment. Now once again, most equipment's over 30 inches wide, so you figure, hey, I got 30 inches, there's nothing to worry about. That's why I'm emphasizing a single standalone full voltage non-reversing starter. Thing's only 8 inches wide. And you've got to have 30 inches of workspace in front of it. Now, this is what the code says. If you're going to comply with it, when you're laying this out, you do a little cross-hatched area 30 inches wide in front of it and make sure nothing encroaches on it. You can't have something sticking out beside the starter that goes into that 30-inch space. That 30-inch space is reserved for the starter. There are also narrow panel boards. Very common to put... Square D has a set of panel boards that fit in the web of a building column. Now, I'm not saying they're easy to wire. They do come with box extensions, so you can do the wiring up above it rather than actually on the circuit breakers. But they fit in the web of a column, and if you think how narrow that is, that certainly isn't 30 inches. Well, if the mechanical guy decides to hang a hose reel on the other side, the 90-degree side of the column, that's fine, but he can't stick out because the electrician still gets his 30 inches in front of the equipment. Clear spaces above and below, and that sounds so easy, except for unknown reasons, the mechanicals always run their piping above electrical equipment. Not permitted. Clear spaces to the structural ceiling. Nothing below it. You have to be very, very careful of running a trough below equipment if the trough sticks out into the workspace for the equipment. A lot of times people fur out the equipment so they can use a deep trough under it. You know, a 12 by 12 trough sticks out 12. So you've got to have the front of your starter above it. Minimum of flush. Okay. There are exceptions, special cases, and interpretations, which very slightly reduce these minimums. The special cases which increase the minimums are higher voltage, required ventilation, and required access to sides and back. Notice that ventilation behind equipment is required in damp environments, that is standoff mounting. This is tremendously interesting. I like to walk through tunnels and look at what the last guy did as I'm going up to my job site, and you can be just about certain half will be mounted flush with the tunnel wall and half will have standoffs. Now, is it a wet environment is the question I have to ask myself. And truthfully, that depends on the climate. There are places where every tunnel is a wet environment. There are places where tunnels are wet environments on some days of the year. And there are places where tunnels are never, ever wet environments. But half of those guys are wrong. Either the half that did the standoff spent money unnecessarily, or the guy who did it flush is buying rust for the client in the future. Personally, I would prefer they all have the standoff, because to me it's just a more tidy method. It just bothers me, the idea of putting an anchor in the wall and screwing the back of the cabinet to it. It just fingernails on chalkboard. It doesn't look like the right way to do it. I handle this for layout of an electric room by creating a block of the actual dimensions of the equipment, then make a dashed envelope which indicates the required access space. My wife taught me this using pieces of paper to locate furniture in the living room. And again, this was at a quarter inch to the foot scale. As the equipment changes, or the electric room changes, or they may change the door locations, you can move the equipment around very easily while maintaining the safety clearances. Warning: it's common for designers to lay out electric gear on both sides of an aisle. If you assume that one side is closed while only the other side is open, then you use the 42 or 48 inch front to front distance. It's legal, but a bad idea. When one side is open, or you're racking out a piece or have tools or maybe a ladder, the aisle is not clear as a path of egress. Much better to consider each side to have a 42 inch clearance space in front of it and an 84 inch aisle. This is safer, but a significant hazard still exists if the door is open on the energized equipment. Arc flash approach radius will still block the aisle if observed during emergency exit use. Clear space above and below is relatively new. Some inspectors are citing as non-compliant an 8-inch trough below a 4-inch panel board, that's the 4-inch deep. They say you must fur out the panel board to maintain the clear space above and below. And it's a very reasonable response in the code, but be aware of the requirement and its interpretation. A special favorable case is truss-mounted dry-type transformers. Since they don't require maintenance, they need not be accessible. With a little cooperation by the inspector, you can place them over electrical equipment. While you're looking at space around equipment, it's good to put in some extra pieces as future. Everyone agrees on capacity for expansion, but a physical representation helps build a consensus and make sure the space is available. A spare 277-480 panel board, a spare 120-208 panel, maybe a spare motor control section. Let's say for certain a spare motor control section. It's very common to add another dry transformer later in the current design for special equipment you didn't know about, maybe hadn't even been selected at the beginning of the design. Try to anticipate and accept the need to fight for valuable square feet of building space. There's a requirement that electric rooms containing 1,200 amps, equipment rated 1,200 amps or more, and over 6 feet wide, have outward swinging doors with panic hardware at each end of the room. If you take a moment to visualize an arc flash event and you are in the room, you will immediately agree that you need to get to a door without crossing the field of blowing copper droplets. There are two special concerns when implementing this rule. First, you must have outward swinging doors with panic hardware. You sometimes have to say this several times and circle it in red on check prints. Second, you don't want to create a preferred normal path of travel for unqualified persons to use the electric room as a shortcut to the bathroom or to the outside door at quitting time. Do provide good lighting and battery-powered emergency lights. Motion sensing switches and energy conservation plans are not permitted. Exhaust fans are implicitly required by the code to meet operating temperatures of the equipment as part of the manufacturer's UL rating. Another thing just popped into my head. I didn't say it here, but very, very good idea to have an oversized double entrance to get equipment in and out. Yeah, you can put the equipment in before the door is mounted, maybe even before the roof is on when you're doing it the first time, but there's going to be a time 20 or 30 years down the road when you're going to want to move in new equipment, and a double wide door just makes life so much better, and in fact, enough space to turn the equipment in the hall and walk it down. Yeah, these things are nice to think about early in the project. Tell you what, I'm going to take a break now and get a drink of water. I suggest you do the same. We'll join again in a moment or perhaps tomorrow.